gonna make a protein synthesis part very quick, probably. Only give you a little bit of information here and there. Especially protein synthesis, gene expression, a very important part, most important part is for the how to use genomes and the genes, how genes are used, open up, and regulation, and how to express the genes. And that is, you know, just the hour or one semester is not enough to talk about it. So I'm not going to tell you almost anything. But gives you a little bit of the, for instance, the hint towards the questions of how these membrane proteins are inserted in the membrane and such. That kind of things are going to give you a little bit of entertainment. Okay, so now multi-unit proteins. And coming to from here to here, the subproteins become mature proteins by accumulating subunits, what we call subunits. For instance, this is hemoglobin and has four subunits, alpha to beta to dimers. And interestingly enough, individual subunit could function it because structurally as well as amino acid sequence-wise, in one way of seeing it, myoglobin, your red meat protein, it's very similar in structure and functions, binding oxygen to hemoglobin. But they have additional interface, and that additional interface not only allows them to bind to each other, but also gives an additional level of regulations. This is myoglobin, this is hemoglobin. And this is another example of these core structures, ribosomes. Ribosomes are, of course, a protein synthesis machinery, and has so many proteins, like 80 some proteins. And as long as I know, we don't have complete catalog list of proteins which you require for ribosomes functions. We don't know even. And all these protein structure within one, you know, polypeptide chain, all subunits, no covalent interactions. With the exception of course, amino acid, you know, amino acid binding to each other. But peptide bond, what we call. And it's not true. This is another covalent interaction takes place in between two cysteine residues. This is amino acid cysteine and another cysteine, and then somebody asked you that they asked the what the sulfate do it. Actually, it makes this what called disulfide bonds. And so this is example of the disulfide bond in insulin. Insulin is a very small protein, but you know, a hormone, and has three disulfide bond formations during the synthesis too. This is just, you know, linearized sequence, so you don't see the 3D structure, but they have three disulfide bonds to stabilize or whatever shapes it. Yes?
What do the disulfide bonds do in keratin?
Keratin, yes. Yes, it's going to come next slide. Yes, that's why. And here's the keratin disulfide bond. It's called permanent wave, otherwise known as. And you go into that, whatever the pot, whatever it is, you go under, you know, undergo massive chemical reactions. And it's true with the keratin, true with collagen maturations. Also, collagen, the time getting maturated means collagen getting tougher and tougher, collagen fibers. Started making more and more this disulfide bond. This bond, it's close enough, cysteine is close enough. They just spontaneously make it. You don't need, there are enzymes facilitate making this, but you don't need enzymes to make this. It's good and it's not good. Sometimes you do protein isolations, you start to make high concentration proteins, and so neighboring molecules, cysteine to cysteine, start to fix each other, and unwillingly, they start to make a sulfide bond. So you get aggregate of the proteins. So you want to add some chemicals preventing from that. Dithiostearate, DTT, you add it, is one purposes to do that. That's pretty much how protein is shaped. And very small part of this, you know, I'm going to give you information, is protein function. And most of protein functions begin with or is binding. Protein binding to protein, ligand protein, substrate protein, ion protein, whatever it is, our enzyme reactions even start with binding. So very fundamental issues of protein functions are always binding. And the binding takes place like this. Okay, here's the sort of, let's say, matched binding or tight binding. But in lesser extent, it could make any bindings on the hydrogen bonding or ionic interactions. And some we call this non-covalent binding or even artifact. It binds to lesser degree or even sometimes more degree to others, which you are not intended to. But binding, it always takes place more or less to other or substrate. Many people lose proteins in testes, vials, because they make a lot of interactions with it. Plastics, for instance. And obviously the water is the issue to remove it. I told some of you, I told you that we had a seminar speaker talking about simulation of this, and she didn't talk about anything of water. And I asked a question, what happens to the water molecules on the shell? And she said, oh, I didn't take into account of the waters because it's too difficult. Thank you very much. So, that the water is very important. And why binding is important, all these structural build-up of cytoskeletons to recombinations, you know, signal transductions, and initial step four enzyme reactions. That's why. And binding, practical information, what I wanted to tell you is this. This is, you know, dissociation constant what we make of this equilibrium. And this is molar concentrations at the dissociation constant. Half molecules supposed to dissociate in the conditions. And within binding is said to be in biological system strongest. One of the strongest, if not strong, the strongest binding. And this negative numbers of deep going to negative means stronger binding. And most of this protein-protein or protein-ligand binding takes place around this nanomolar range. I said more or less. And just keep in your mind, and ion binding takes place mostly in micromolar range, or 10 to the 6 molar range. And these are, as a consequence, proteins, ligands, or ions in the positions exist, order less or a little order more, in the condition, cytoplasm or extracellular matrix, when it's functioning. In turn, if you do the experiment, you are mostly theoretical biologist, so it's maybe not a big deal, but if I use the ligand or something, or inhibitors or something, I always take a look at some kind of numbers like this, and use closer range to that. Yes?
Just another comment on this. These are
Right, right.
And so the next challenge, when people like Evan Evans are looking at that, is to convert that energy into the kind of force required to break the bond.
Mm-hmm.
And a very fundamental thing that he's found out, and other people are going to agree, is that the force to break a bond depends on the loading rate of that bond. And it's now, people are now thinking about this as an escape from a free energy minimum down some path.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do see these bonds now as real materials that are put together, or in the lock and key kind of idea, but there's an escape, and the bias in having them might have, you know, huge amounts of energy involved in this bond, but it escapes through a pathway.
Mm-hmm.
Now that bond can stay together for maybe 3 months in your test tube, where the forcing function now is just thermal energy. But if you manage to pull on that bond, it can break in a millisecond. But now the force is huge, it can break. So it can break without force or break with force, depending on the loading rate. So there's a lot of nice physics and mathematics and modeling now in taking these biological numbers of energy and converting them to force for failure.
Well, that is, maybe that's important nowadays, but we do more direct measurement of molecule modeling, like using modified cantilever systems.
Yeah,
AFM and such.
This biointerface probe that Evan has, and so the techniques are now available to get the data.
Right.
To calculate, the principle is that there are no unitary forces in nature.
Mm-hmm.
There are loading rates.
Right. So that's another importance, yes.
Appearing loading, yeah.
Yes, I always told students that don't use too much molecules or too little molecules to do the experiment. You always take a look at these numbers. Most of these numbers or similar ones are available in literatures or handbooks. And, you know, take a look at the first before you buy important, very expensive chemicals, please. I always said that because these numbers are not just to memorize. And as you see, it's mostly in a group of molecules and within the range. And another thing with regards to energy is enzymatic reactions. What enzyme does is lower this reaction energy here to this much. And this is in terms of conventional thermodynamics view, some quantum mechanics people now may have say something differently a little bit, but important things here, why it's binding to, this is to explain to 99% of the population, I can convince this. This is, I took from my boss's ex-mentor's textbook on it's imaginal enzyme called stickase. You break this stick, and this is metal stick, so you cannot do it really with the hands. You know, you need a lot of energy. But stickase somehow breaks it. How it does, that's a point. Here, binding of the stick to the enzyme is not completely complementary at the beginning. This is classical enzymology view of it. But initial binding alterate, change enzyme structure itself. And the structure changing the enzyme induced by binding, initial binding substrate provides energy. In other words, binding of this or what, you know, biochemists, we call this energy provided by substrate itself provide enough energy to lower this reaction energy to break the stick. If, like this receptor arbitin binding or receptor ligand binding, perfect match takes place in the binding in the first place, this complex is even more stable than the other one. And breaking of this in this condition, you're just making yourself more difficult. Requires more energy. This is how, you know, easiest way to explain it in just 1 minute of enzymatic reaction in hand. And this transition here is, you know, I think first this coin will be Don Cashron, I think 60s, made this name as an induced fit. So protein induces fit structure, the fit into, and that makes the catalytic activities. Does it make sense? So if this happens at the beginning of the enzyme, you know, okay, substrate, you need really rather require more energy to break this because now you have to deal with both. And that leads to this also the binding and also these issues leads to the issue of inhibitions. Many inhibitions take place. Mainly, this is not only enzymes, but also any binding receptors and such. If one is called reversible or competitive, you know, all irreversibles. Reversible ones, in a way, substrate or one binding component compete with others. So you design the substrate or inhibitors similar in shape to one side, but competing it, and then this does not make these other ones to function. Or some inhibitors bind the other place and rocking this changing structure like this. By binding this, it prevents from these changes. So it's called uncompetitive inhibitions, classical ways. And there, you know, you can take a look at, or if you remember, open your textbook, biochemistry textbook, it shows how to distinguish one or the other, or mixture of this, with classical enzymatic kinetics. Other type of inhibition is called irreversible. Means you, mostly, many of these irreversible inhibitors are covalent linkage of some residues into catalytic domain of enzymes. I use PMSF a lot. This is very highly toxic. Just be careful if you receive the sample from somebody and it says has PMSF. This is very, very toxic chemical. But we often use this to inhibit enzymes. Even stronger ones, because DFP or DIFP, this even goes into the air, become volatile and go into the air and kills you. That's very similar to one of these nerve gases. Some nerve gases like sarin and such are exactly this type of the irreversible inhibitors of many enzymes. Yes?
Does the fluoride have anything to do with their toxicity?
That's a good question. I remember why it was very toxic. It's a highly reactivity of these molecules. So fluoride itself contributes. I don't remember. Yeah, but how it's toxic. It's different, they have different levels of toxicity. One is this reactivity to this. To be honest with you, PMSF is very, very labor in water, in one level. People misuse this making solutions on PMSF prepared hours before do the experiment. It doesn't work anymore. PMSF in the water, half-life is in room temperature is about 30 minutes or less. Even in the on ice, it's less than 30 minutes. But after it's getting hydrolyzed, they're still very toxic. So another level of toxicity takes place, which I never took a look at it, but I know it's toxic. It inhibits enzymes, especially inhibits many enzymes. Inevitably, it's toxic to you as well. And another issues of binding or such, you know, let me just go through this without any discussions and to show you that what they have is. Many of these subunit structures can influence each other in this case, this is called allostatic enzymes. And the modulator, subunit, or what you call regulatory domain of the protein, binds molecules and change not only its conformation, but catalytic domain of the enzyme. That makes catalysis faster or slower. So these intermolecule interactions or conformation change between molecules takes place, and it changes activities. That's binding to binding of these molecules are very important. Not only the enzymes, but the receptors, the ligands, is important. Even now, we know that the cytoskeletal proteins just binding to each other makes totally different characteristics of these. So protein-protein interaction is largely untapped area in theories. And last one, he is talking about phosphorylation. Phosphorylation obviously adds charges, and that charges makes environment easier or harder. Two things they do. Charges facing towards the inside or towards its own molecule introduces conformational changes. Number two, charges, this charge, make it easier to break the water shell. It's true with many TPMCs. Water shells are very difficult to defeat. I told you that the water surrounded all these enzymes and substrate. ATP is surrounded by water, okay? ATPase is surrounded by water. And making ATP into the ATP catalytic pocket of an ATPase is very difficult. You add magnesium, for instance. Ions break this shell, harder shell, to let them go into easier. Dirty secret tricks. Many, many enzymes are activated by detergent like triton-600 and such. That makes breaks the water shell. Phosphorylation disturbs water shell. That's how enzyme may be regulated as well, or binding. And this conformational change is, as I said, it's a very difficult question how it takes place. For instance, in the famous case, the textbook case of this conformational change between subunit is hemoglobin binding of oxygen. And the hemoglobin has two affinity states, low affinity binding and high affinity binding to the oxygen. And then they undergo transitions. As soon as they start to bind one oxygen in one of the subunits, they influence other subunits to undergo to high affinities, or vice versa. This is almost the same kind of principle myoglobin binds oxygen, but because it is the single subunit unit protein, so it does not have this allosteric effect, so it just makes simple high power. You have myoglobin in your muscle, enough to be simple, but in the hemoglobin in the bloodstream makes this to carry the water and oxygen from your lung into the tissues and releases because of this. And all these others, insulin receptors and such, are important to consider on these conformational changes on the intermolecular structures. That's what take-home message is. And largely, even here, I mean, no ignorance for its lipid protein interactions. Obviously, it's important, of course, but that kind of thing is very largely untapped area still. Yeah. So, and let's quickly go into how these guys are made. And one of the take-home messages here. Here's the genome, probably, all the DNA amounts. You know, everybody heard it about 7 years ago, complete human genome, in other words, nucleotide sequence of your entire chromosomes, is sequenced. Everything we spell out. However, this is about sort of you know ballpark percentage of constituent of this your genomes here. Transposons are not genes. It's good. It hops here and there around within the chromosomes in the very unique area, and genes. And then miscellaneous, and the miscellaneous on the you know codes for ribosomal RNAs and such also, but 70% we still have 1/5 about. We have no idea what they do. We have absolutely no idea what they do, and even within genes, most of the portions are introns are no coding segments, and exons are the human actual gene coding for proteins. 1.4% of entire these chromosomes are actually coding proteins. Rest of them, we have some ideas, and at least we know that the transposons, we have behaviors, but the many, many even, we don't know actual coding of this, they do what they do. And interestingly, also another issue is, when these are opened and transferred into RNAs, not only this portion, but there are many, many portions are also transcribed to make it to RNA. And many areas of RNAs are unused, obviously. And, yes? Yes, this portion there,
yes.
And some of the transposon area, I think, goes into the RNA as well. And this area certainly is RNA for messenger RNA, not messenger, ribosome RNA, small RNA, and ribosome RNA. So these are four RNAs for RNAs. And the rest of the things, so many mysterious RNAs exist.
But specifically the messenger.
That is quote unquote, sometimes it comes in the tail and such, which we don't know. And I'm not specialist, and I think it's case by case, so probably. But these RNAs now, we thought were just a waste of the rest of the RNA regions, at least in here or so. Now, people say that there are sort of inhibitory or regulatory functions of these RNAs. And depending on who you ask, people tell you different stories. And point is, you know, the central dogma was one gene or one gene makes exactly one messenger RNA and make exactly one polypeptide chain. That's the story was. And just going very quickly, first here, and nowadays we know it's not necessarily true. That is true in bacteria. Bacterial DNA transmit what is called transcription to make messenger RNA, which is usable template for making protein. And it's one by one, this ratio here, 1:1:1. But eukaryotes have this intron containing RNAs and DNAs, and it's first made as primary RNA transcript, and it has making a whole slew of processing to make mature messenger RNA to be used for template. And what happens is it makes splicing like this. Going here, the problem is your messenger RNA now can be spliced in different manners, depending on cells, depending on conditions, what's called alternative splicing. So intron is not dead waste spacer, but can make a sort of structural as well as functional signal or whatever binding site to ligate this part to this part to this part. This is all what we call tropomyosin, tropomyosin, and what we call subtype of the proteins made from one gene. And depending on where you are, which kind of cells you take a look at it, this corresponds to different kinds of subspecies of protein. And here it comes in the point, five different versions of proteins are made from one DNA. And even, for instance, you know, it goes into worse. For instance, the liver has specific enzymes and making difference in this nucleotide sequence and making long version of polypeptide chain and also short version of polypeptide chain, because it makes change in the nucleic acid and makes stop codon in the middle of it. So what if you remember that this one gene to one protein theory no longer valid? Just that's one point I wanted to make. And here is two examples of these introns. How much introns you have versus exon? Exon is primarily the area of coding for protein sequence. And I said here, not all exons are used even. So gene sequence, take sequence from the genome and guesstimate protein is pretty dangerous job these days. And the other thing is, important thing is here, is how much in the proteins you need to make it. This cell is small, but for instance, digestive enzymes, mucus proteins, mucins, milk protein casings, you dispose as it is made and then consume. So you make a lot of these proteins in the cells. Immunoglobulins, peptide hormones as well, or extracellular matrix proteins, as well as keratin. However, for instance, this is my rough calculations of protein actin and also tubules. They're about maximally probably 100 micromolar of the actin in cytoplasm. And this is said to be highest number of the soluble cytoplasmic proteins in the cell. That's highest number. Most of the proteins in the concentration of nanomolar or 10 nanomolar range, if you converted the protein into concentration. And but this, in that this kind of realistic size of prototypical cell, and only this much of the 10 to the 6 of the actual molecules of the active in this volume. Saying that this is the volume ignoring all these other components. Whereas 1 micrometer length of actin filament contains 450 molecules. So about 2,000 filaments you can make over 1 micrometer, and when you see the actin filaments all over the cell, microvilli has hundreds of actin each and such, these belts. And these are the major, by far the major proteins. Still, only this much protein number available here. Or tubulin is odorless, exists in the cell, and this is still major protein if you run this page of entire cell proteins. And it's only 10 to the 5th tubulin. And nonetheless, my point is, most of the proteins exist in much less than amount in the cell. And you know, biochemists or cell biologists make it to the molar concentration of this, how much you have it. But It comes down to the individual size of the cell. It's not many molecules. That's the whole point I wanted to make it. So you don't need, you want to say something more?
Well, yeah, I think this is a good point for the mathematicians, especially the statisticians now, to start thinking about probability when there's only a few choices.
Yeah. Two orders smaller than this. So how many proteins or ligands are such in this side? Like sometimes come to the point you get negative numbers.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense. It's negative numbers, the protein exists.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about having enough DNA to go around the earth twice or something. But the level of where science is done, there's only a few molecules involved. So this predictability, the kind of thing we talked about yesterday about, you know, uncertainty or undeterminism exists at this kind of scale, and that's what brings some new mathematics.
Mm-hmm. So just to remind you to, you know, yes, and it's, I thought it's important, reality of this world. And another thing, so all you know is this gene coding is made by these three letters of nucleic acid, we call it codon. And some, then the three letters corresponds to amino acid, one amino acid. Some of these combinations are, you know, six combinations, different combinations used for serine, whereas methionine is unique, one codon, these three combinations. And there are codon biases then in life takes place. In other words, you have six choices, some animals or some plants prefers this kind of codon versus that kind of codon. And I cannot explain why, but that number one, if you take a gene from one, let's say plant gene, to put into another organism, we always translate this codon to whatever this organism prefers in the codon. Makes much better efficiency to make proteins and such. One is I know that there is a metabolism of this nucleotide availability in the cell. Some gets more GC, some more is available in the AT. But other reasons we cannot explain is this codon bias takes place. So some prefers one of these, and the other prefers another serine is somewhere over serine here, like this. And just putting, theoretically, both works on any cells, but in reality, some cells prefer this codon versus that codon. So, you know, it's a problem. And also mitochondria, I told you had some DNAs and we use, and they're strictly maternal. And the mitochondrial codon usage is somewhat screwed or different from main codon usage. It makes story a little more complicated. But mitochondria does not have enough gene pools to make its own. I tell you why, okay? But how this codon, three codon, is transferred into amino acid chain is by this molecule called amino acid transfer RNA, tRNA. And structure is RNA with this clover structure is bound with by a phosphate, alpha phosphate, into adenosine monophosphate here, made from ATP here. And here is number four carbon binds amino acid group, amino acid biocarbonate group. So you carry amino acid here and this adapter here plus transfer RNA. And the particular fork of this arm or fork here is called anticodon arm and has this unique messages or codon here. And so enzymes always prepare this one by one by one and keep enough of it to make protein synthesis. And since we have 61 codon combinations for proteins, three are stop codon and does not carry any amino acid. But all the other 61 codon you may be used, so you have to have 61 different versions of this, not 20 different versions of this. So you have to have enough in cytoplasm anytime to make proteins. It's a lot of work. And how they do is, by one by one, they coming in and then making this peptide bond from N-terminal towards C-terminal to elongate this peptide chain. And, but to do this, it requires an appropriate platform. And that is ribosome. Ribosome is mega gigantic protein RNA complex, consists of two subunits. And some are found in the cytoplasm, some are bound to membrane, I explained to you why. And it's assembled in even nucleus to come into this cytoplasm. And has these two subunits. And the bigger subunit has this amino acid tRNA binding site, and smaller subunit binds messenger RNA template. And I'm not going to go into detail on this, but important things here is it makes one by one, attaching it, shifting it, and then ligating it. This cyclic reaction of this, binding it, attaching it, shifting this subunit to each other to make this elongation from N-terminal. So protein started to get out from this big subunit as chain here. And this repeated fraction, this is called elongation. And to do the elongation, you have to bring this amino acid TRN into a particular site. And that itself requires GTP energy. And this is trials and errors. It has three layers and the combination of, you know, its affinities. Many times it makes mismatch. It's not that different from each other sometimes. So
A to T, C to G. So
right.
Why there's an error?
Well, if it's two out of three matches, maybe it has some affinity already.
Yeah, so this also we should have perfect match.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So, and they have some checking mechanisms here and there. And if incorrectly based pairs, match is not exact, probably this binding of these two amino acid tRNA is not exactly probably aligned, so it may dispose. But sometimes it is escapes, and again, try again. And even sometimes it goes through it. So you get the wrong amino acid in it. It happens. And so it's not really nicely aligned. And also, try and error each time you waste two GTPs. You need a lot of energies to make proteins. That's the whole point. I wanted to say. And another important thing is protein synthesis always start with methionine. This is unique initiator. And especially special initiator methionine transfer RNA is used for initiation. So amino acid number one must be methionine, at least when it's made. And third important thing is termination. Finally, some call genetic code here is called stop codon, and that makes you to stop these reactions, and then that's it. It released these chains, finally released from ribosomes. Mutation of this accidentally makes stop codon, so you can making the protein shorter ones. Some of the mutations take place like that. And how this is made? Important things here is, first of all, how many ribosomes? Because it's so much steps required. I don't know, I didn't get any numbers in the mammalian cells or human cells, but even the E. coli, there are 15,000 ribosomes said to be. In the small E. coli cells. And together with all these enzymes, it consists about one third of total E. coli proteins. Requires a lot to make proteins in ours. And another one is how fast it goes. And this is also E. coli case, about 20 peptides per second. Biochemists said this is fast. Chemist says this is enormously slow. So to make proteins, and this is about 2 kb protein is, it doesn't exist. Many proteins are 20 kilodaltons, 100 kilodaltons, few hundred kilodaltons easily. So just to make one protein requires time. And to circumvent that problem, if you need some, a lot of proteins in case, for instance, secretory proteins or such, using one template of messenger RNA and a bunch of ribosomes hanging on to one messenger RNA and continuously making proteins in it. So one messenger RNA can be used at time to make many, many proteins. In other words, amplified. This is only in case of some proteins. We know some cases, one messenger RNA makes only one copy of the protein and degrade it. That's it.
So does it mean it depends on the half-life of the messenger RNA then? Is that
right. And also how many ribosomes can associate it into that. And it's some part we understand, some part we don't yet. And normally this amplification takes place. Even messenger RNA, some messenger RNA from one gene expression takes a lot of transcription. One gene to a time make many messenger RNAs. Sometimes one messenger RNA is only made. So 1 to 1 to 1 protein. Sometimes 1 to 100, 100 times 100 here. So it depending on the issues, and I'm not molecular biologist, so I cannot say how this regulated. It's very complicated, but that takes place amplifications, especially consider that this is a slow process and you need a lot of proteins to make. So how it's made? Okay, it's made like I skipped very briefly on the skin surface of the protein elongations, or peptide elongations, and it comes out from ribosomes. I don't think that comes out like from that hole, but then. And immediately start to take place these secondary structures or primer of whatever small domains, alpha helix or beta sheets and such by itself. And then additional process or additional systems makes even further to fold these proteins, make mature proteins. That's another issue I will talk about a little bit here. Next one, yes. There are proteins called molecular chaperones and the chaperonins. One most famous one is HSP70, 70 kilodalton protein. And they are ATPase and hang around with these synthesizing proteins and helping making shapes. This process, we start to understand it's very complicated, but requires energy. And what is HSP heat shock protein? Originally, it was found as heat shock. When you change the temperature of the environment of the cells, they started to make, you know, they start to cry and they start to make another set of proteins. And all of a sudden, you start to see a lot of this because you need a lot of HSP70 for many, many protein folding. That's why we originally named this as HSPs. But that is called molecular chaperones. And these kind of proteins require many, many protein synthesis. Like tubulins I use requires this. And E. coli has some of them, but not all of them. So we cannot make tubulins in E. coli. Here, in mammalian cells, we have big difficult problems here. There are many, many proteins going different locations. Cytoplasmic protein is, that's what I, you know, just explained like the ways. But some other protein goes out, go into the membranes, go into the organelle or in the nucleus. So how they do is the key issues. And most of the cytoplasmic protein are protein synthesis, or in other words, these ribosomes making proteins in the cytoplasm. The cytoplasmic proteins and nuclear proteins going to nucleus. Many of the mitochondrial proteins are made first in the cytoplasm, or peroxisomal proteins. This is a special case. And they all have this special amino acid sequence called signal sequence or localization sequence, and has adapters more or less somewhere. In case this is a nuclear localization signal here, part of this amino acid sequence is recognized by adapter protein here, important, what's called, and this allows this protein to pass through this nuclear pore into the nucleus. So without this, it cannot go in. Or if you eliminate this experimentally, it doesn't go in, or vice versa. True with mitochondria. But mitochondria is a little bit more problem because there are mitochondrial proteins inside here in the matrix, inside this space, but also proteins in the outer membrane and inner membranes. So they have very complicated systems to import the mitochondrial proteins made in cytoplasm and have many different signal sequences. For instance, this is the pathways to go into inner membranes here. And first is inside, and this TIM-TOM complex is importing mechanisms. And start to pull in here, and then depending on the pathways, first case is just they go in, everything go in, and signal sequence cleaved by protease. And still has second signal sequence bound by this OXA complex, and that inserts this region and flow the rest of the region, this interstitial space. And, or, stop at here, and then rest of this, you put it inside here this way or this way. Either way, you can put the protein in inner membrane and the facing domains is in between here. And if you cleave this here, you can make soluble protein in between here. Such protein also exists. So you make it this into here. or other cases is going different directions from here, and the first one is held, but the other one is sent into this inner membrane. Or these proteins going all the way in or held in the middle of this to make outer membrane proteins. I don't know every single protein we looked at in the mitochondria all go through this, but now we believe this few different signal sequence and combination of it, making very complicated that there membrane protein formations in mitochondria. Remember that the cytochrome complex that transfer even the electron inside this complex to make ATP. So protein-protein association within the membrane is very unique and has to be exact. So that's how mitochondrial protein goes in. Now, main part of this juicy part is to how to make plasma membrane protein or secretory protein. And that is going in and is made essentially with endoplasmic reticulum here. And how they do is this way. First, it starts just like regular one. Ribosomes start to make proteins. But they have a special signal sequence started to make here in one part of this green. This is protein, this is a messenger RNA, this is ribosome. And when this has on the signal sequence at here's N terminal, its adapter proteins also available here, SRP complex and such, and locate this into this pore complex. And once it located into this mitochondria, ribosomes, docked on the surface of this endoplasmic reticulum and put these dots onto the surface of it. So these dots actually are ribosomes making proteins on the surface of it. Ribosome itself, we believe, is the same ribosomes we use to make cytoplasmic proteins and such, but it goes a little differently. And then start to throw this chain inside, like this. And then, if the secretory protein, protease cuts here at the end, so signal sequence is left in the membrane and the rest of the protein stays here. So here's the beginning of this protein sequence. Methionine must be here, somewhere over here. So this protein, unless it happened to be methionine here, it's not methionine anymore. And this is throwing to the endoplasmic reticulum inside what is called rumen or cistern. This is done with this SRP binding complex and opening the pore and such takes place with this interaction with receptors, with SRP and such. And actually it is, some research showed that this has a pore, interestingly. Actually this pore is found first, and that led us to study mitochondrial protein import and such. Before that, we had no idea. We thought the protein warped into the mitochondria. So, and here's the signal sequence here. It's mostly a leucine, valine, alanine, such a little different signal sequences, but this much of this peptide sequence makes the proteins to send it to either into lumen or stain cytoplasm. So you can engineer the protein to make the protein stain in cytoplasm or original cytoplasmic protein to secrete it to outside. just adding this sequence. Now it's possible to engineer that way. And interestingly enough, how this process is not only made with the secretory protein, but also plasma membrane protein as well. This is secretory protein. It's cut with the single peptidase, and it stayed in here. But if it's a membrane protein, another set of the variation that is sequence, signal sequence, kept it in place, and the peptidase cannot cleave this. So it stays like this. So transmembrane domain cross equal this signal domain. And the variations here on how to insert this into different directions. So some protein, amino terminal on the one side, the other protein, carboxy terminal on the other side. Or in case of this multi-domain protein, you have so many of these signal or stop signal sequences and going and out, in and out, to insert it into multi-domain like this. So consequently, these sequences here are more or less the signal sequence for insertions. That's what we believe. And to put into this small space is hectic work. And again, this HSP70 work. As soon as these proteins here, coming into here, HSP70 started to hold peptides coming into, and then we don't know the mechanism yet, but they obviously assist putting the protein into this lumen. Another important, this is practically important issues. Most of the proteins, secretory proteins, are membrane proteins, are glycosylated. And what is called N-linked oligosaccharide to asparagine molecules. And this is what they are here, all this sugar, complex sugar, by asparagine, by these amino groups. And it's called this N because it's what we call N-linked. And this is done by a particular enzyme from this donor called this lipid sugar complex, phosphate complex into. This sugar complex is assembled actually the other side first and somehow flip-flops the inside to be used. And then they are attached to the proteins. Why is I'm making big issue of this? First of all, part of this glucose is used to signal whether a protein is properly folded or not inside this rumen. And go in and check it, and if it's okay, and if it removes the glucose, checking proteins must exist here, and if it's okay, exit this process to go to the next step. If not, if it's not folded right, it adds glucose again, and then go into this folding mechanism again, and trying again until if it's right, whether it's right. So you're right that it's not 100% protein folding and such is 100% right. It misshapes take place and they error checks. And if I don't know how many times it has to go, but if it's too much of it, it has a special mechanism to use the same hole but to the other directions to go into this proteasome, which is protein breakdown machinery inside the plasma, send it to that and then just break down. Mm-hmm. okay, this cannot be used, bye bye. But you, at least you can recycle amino acids. And another way of binding proteins into membrane is another linker. It's cleaved here with the similar sequence as well, but now attaching to the lipid via this sugar linker. That takes place. And that's what it happens here. It's called rough endoplasmic reticulum, RER, with this attach here. And then protein are not ready yet. And it goes maturation in Golgi apparatus. And this is a very complicated process. Golgi is like a membrane stack, and it appears to be discontinuous membrane stacks with vesicles. And when protein goes in from here to here, proteins are undergoing many, many modifications, many, depending on proteins. And it happens with this taking out as a vesicle and adding to the one place, and maybe hopping through this vesicle from one place to the other into this last place before it goes to the outside. And this process always actually requires molecular motors and microtubules, and also integrity of Golgi and the ER itself is held in cell by these cytoskeletal elements, which people ignore it, but no way it is. And it just, understand that we don't know how this protein transition takes place from here to here exactly, but it takes place. Some people think that this itself going maturation. Some people think this hopping takes place. But nonetheless, there are another modification many proteins like collagens receives is in the Golgi. This O-linked oligosaccharides. Now, serine threonine, the same place that the phosphorylation takes place, but it receives another sugars in Golgi. A lot of these sugar are used. These oligosaccharides are, I told you that the error checking in the first, and the ER, but also when it's released, even they, some of them use as binding site or ligand site. So it's very physiologically important. Bacteria does not make this. So bacterial made protein lacks all this glycosylation. Sometimes does not function just because of lacking of glycosylations. And other major modification is proteolysis. It cuts protein to make mature. This is the case of insulin. Insulin is made by one polypeptide, but all through modifications, after disulfide bond is made, it cuts here and making into small two peptides linked to each other. So you lose many of these peptides already made. Another processing. And another sugar importance is one of these sugar is used to target particular protein into go to Golgi, from Golgi into this lysosome in digestive enzymes with the one sugar added or not. This one sugar, without one sugar, it goes outside. One sugar is retained in the lysosomes and used as the digestive enzymes. So these sugars are very important for direction signals, where to go and what to do. And again, I said bacterial enzymes. Bacteria does not make this. And the yeast makes it, but yeast makes it very simpler only once. So if you think that the protein requires glycosylation, bacterial protein doesn't work. Going to yeast, many people do. but yeast glycosylation may not be still enough. Insect cell makes it, but yet different glycosylation. So some insect cell made protein works. Some proteins don't work for us. All these problems exist, especially industry-wise, engineering-wise. Now, German group trying to make industrial yeast with all this mammalian glycosylation enzymes in. So they tried to make mammalian protein in yeast with all these enzymes attached inside. And lastly, close to lastly, it's important things, even they're making it, they fuse these vesicles finally from Golgi to going to this vesicle to going to surface, fusing to plasma membrane. And if you are, you know, digesting enzyme and such, it goes out one way or home or the other way. But as I told you that in the first lecture, it has to go in correct direction. Otherwise, you screw up everything. You release digestive enzyme inside your blood, you know, circulation, start to break everything, or vice versa. Deal with all these receptors and glucose transporters, ion pumps and everything here. So we know that as long as we know or we cannot distinguish Golgi apparatus for this side or that side going, we believe it's a unified protein production. But somehow, from after this process, it has some way of commanding in this way or that way to make protein insertion or secretion one way but not the others. That is largely we don't understand yet how it works. And lastly, our protein is broken down. Always, you know, people have big problems, and there are many times engineers ask me, what is MTBF of this protein? MTBF stands for mean a break between
mean time between failure.
And all these mechanical parts and such, or machinery has MTBF. Your watch to everything, cars. And people ask me, what's the MTBF this protein? And nobody can translate it. That's a problem. Protein, depending on largely the conditions, lasts long or very short in time. And even in the cell, they break it. It misfolds it, you know, or breaking down, whatever it is. And this is a system, one of the systems where we know it's a protein particle. And it's like about the garbage pail, like kind of things, and disposal built in. So you throw the protein inside, and protein's degraded, and the amino acids coming out from this particle, in essence. And to that, you first add this small protein called ubiquitin. First, they found this protein all over every single cell. That's why they named it ubiquitously everywhere. And they attach this protein, enzyme attaches protein into your target protein, or protein to be broken down. And this makes a signal for ubiquitin. Has an affinity to this entrance of garbage pail. And then they throw the rest of the target protein inside, and then it's broken down. That's how they break it down, all the proteins inside the cell. This is one way, but we know there are other ways we don't understand. Not ubiquitin dependent, but the protein degradation takes place. So, and as I told you that we don't know MTBF, but one study shows that this N-terminal of the amino acid, depending on what amino acid you have in the N-terminal, in the given condition, even life changes, life of the protein changes. a lot, or very easily denatured or stayed longer. Methionine is good, that's most of protein has, but you crave it for, you know, this reason or that reason, so you may lose it. And this is what we don't know, and we like to know this answer with all the simulations, and which conditions are more favorable for this protein or that protein with all this pH or the ions and such. That's what, you know, I wanted to emphasize, took a little long time, but to emphasize this is, you know, how to control protein life is very important for engineering, because bioengineering, protein, we like to make sensors, biosensors, and many things, but they don't last minutes. Commercially, you know, it's not feasible to have this. So if we can design a better protein with a longer life, just adding something or changing something, that's a very big advantage. Oh, that's pretty much all these gene expressions on the proteins are, you can find in every single textbook of biochemistry or even cell biology or physiology textbook these days. So that's you know, you can read textbook information image or ask your students to explain to you. That may be easiest. But all this, that the number of the protein actually, how many are the cells, or these kind of informations are not much emphasized in textbooks, but they're very important issues in life these days. So, I thought that I wanted to emphasize this just for this tutorial purpose. So that is, I think, I believe, the last one.